Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or good morning if you're in California, blogging theology. My name is Paul Williams, and today we have a very special, distinguished scholar, Dr. Abdullah bin Hamid Ali. You're most welcome to Blogging Theology, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
And Dr. Ali has been on Blogging Theology before, of course, and but I will just briefly mention who he is. According to the Zaytuna College website, where he teaches, he is a scholar of Islamic law, and his research interests include the interconnection between law and identity formation, comparative Islamic law, and Islam's role in the modern world. And at Zaytuna Institute, or college rather, in California, Dr. Ali teaches jurisprudential principles, family law, inheritance law, commercial law, prophetic tradition, creedal theology, and Islamic virtue ethics. And Dr. Ali got his PhD from the Graduate Theological Union in 2016. He has written a great deal, actually. And you can see some of his work in the Lamppost Education Institute, where there's an article, a particular article. We're going to discuss the issues arising from the article. It's called The Homosexual Challenge to Muslim Ethics. The Homosexual Challenge to Muslim Ethics. You can just Google that, or you can go straight to the Lamppost Education Initiative website. And it's a very erudite, I think, and balanced and moderate, that's the right word, treatment of the subject, which is really forefront in many activists' minds in the West when it comes to establishing the normalcy and the acceptability of behaviors which Islamically are not accepted. Dr. Ali, can I just ask, first of all, why you wrote this article, and perhaps give an overview of what it's about for us?
Oh, yeah, that's a very good question. I'm glad you asked that question. And there's an interesting backstory to the publication, or let's say the posting of that particular article. I started studying at the Graduate Theological Union in 2009, the spring of 2009, and I was working on my master's degree in ethics and social theory. I took a particular course at one of the seminaries, this particular class had multiple people who we would say belong to the far left, right? And there were some in the class who had an association, claimed an association with Islam, although I think for most mainstream Muslims would really be very skeptical about their commitment and conviction to Islam. And one of our assignments, we had, well, not just one, but for the semester, we had an obligation to interact with one another on an online platform. And one particular post by one individual was that Islam endorses homosexual acts, and that, you know, that there were people who were arguing that it was okay for these, that there was nothing problematic about it. And I challenged this particular question, this assertion. And the particular student started to post some quotes from certain people who they considered to be authoritative in the Islamic area of Islamic law and others, and people who most people wouldn't know anything about or never heard from. I told her that that realistically, that, you know, nobody would actually consider any of these people to be authorities, and it's very clear from the Quran that there's no basis for this. Now, this particular individual, although claiming to be a Muslim, also identified as a lesbian. And so we started to have a back and forth. And at a certain point, she shut down. And I continued. Of course, I wasn't as sensitive as probably should have been to her situation, because I didn't realize at first, okay, her shutting down or her not responding anymore probably has something to do with her feeling attacked, right? You know, by me, you know. And so naturally, when you come to accept that, okay, I'm a Muslim and this is okay to be the way that I am, based upon your belief that Muslim scholars are okay with this. And so you start to feel attacked. So eventually this led to larger class discussion, right, because of this exchange. And I gave students an opportunity to sort of criticize me and to attack me. And of course, I responded, right? But you know, of course, the claims that I was being badgered or painted as the intolerant one, you know, and I had to highlight to them that, you know, I think that you're very intolerant as well, right? So, you know, you called me judgmental. I'm, you know, I think you're very judgmental too. At any rate, I completed my degree, and then I started the PhD program. And so, during the PhD program, because of this particular incident, the story of or the topic of homosexuality in particular was something weighing heavily on me, because up until that point, it had never been a major issue or point of discussion in the Muslim community nationally in the West, right? So one particular course I took was entitled Anthropology and Ethics, and it was led by two graduate students, a male and a female. They were Catholics, and basically we had a final paper, and I chose to write about this topic from a Catholic perspective, right? You know, actually we went into Thomas Aquinas, and actually one of the early courses I took during my MA was in Catholic moral theology, or moral theology from a Thomistic perspective, right? So I had, the original article didn't include any references to Islam, right? So
really interesting. So here were you, a Muslim scholar, writing, articulating the position from St. Thomas Aquinas, who is probably the most preeminent Roman Catholic theologian in the medieval period, if not of all time.
Right.
And I just find it's not ironic. Well, it is ironic in a sense, but what I understand, Thomism is the name of the school of thought that comes out of Thomas. Thomas and Thomas Aquinas.
Right.
He was around alive about the time that Ibn Taymiyyah was alive, funnily enough.
Right.
I mean, chronologically, obviously, they don't think he ever had tea together. But I've always been struck by his theology, his understanding of ethics, and what they call virtue ethics. This is the modern expression of Thomist ethics.
Right.
People like Alistair MacIntyre, this British professor who's now in America for years, for some reason, whatever. But how similar the way it's expressed is to many ways of expressing it in Islam, in terms of the emphasis on what Catholics call natural law, the way we are constituted as human beings in a particular way, male and female, and the complementarity, and so on. I don't want to take away your point here, but I was just struck by that many parallels between the traditional Catholic understanding and the Islamic understanding throughout history.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that there's two major reasons for that, for the overlap. Is one is because we share, prophets, right? That we are part of a continuum of divine intervention into human societies, and so we call the Abrahamic traditions. So naturally there's going to be overlap in morality from between Muslims and Catholics and other, like Jews as well, as well as Protestants. But the other reason I would say is because we share in our mutual benefit from the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, and in particular Aristotle. Also Plato, but I think more so Aristotle has probably had a larger influence on Muslim theologians, at least mainstream theologians, than Plato, perhaps. But I think that those two reasons are sufficient for us to see a lot of overlap in that much of what we see shared between the two traditions is significant, pretty significant in the moral realm. Right. Yeah. So basically what happened is, like I said, so I took this course and I wrote my paper. It was focused on the Catholic tradition. At the end of that particular course, we were asked as students to share our papers with one another. Of course, unbeknownst to me, there was actually one student who was hypersensitive, who I suspect actually was gay. He was from a different country. He wasn't from the U.S., so he had some very negative comments about my particular paper. And also went ahead and attacked the Prophet Muhammad because of that, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And at any rate, you know, the teachers, the students who are in charge, the graduate students who are in charge, they told me that his comments weren't going to have any impact on my grade. And actually, they told me that I was very brave to actually even delve into the topic itself. Right. So basically, once I had finished that course and then later on my PhD, I felt that it was important to actually, I hadn't finished my PhD yet before I actually added the Islamic material to this particular article, because this article, when you read it, you can tell that it actually emerged prior to the Supreme Court ruling legalizing gay marriage, which was in 2015. Right. So I wrote it prior to 2015 and posted it. And at the time, the Muslim community really were very nervous about the topic. They didn't really want to publicly speak about it, either for or against, you know, but we've come a long way since then. Right. You know, and I think at the time, I'm relatively certain that my article probably was the only one that was available. Right. From an Islamic perspective at the time. You know, since then, many have been written.
So I didn't realize you're a pioneer and your work is seminal. I do recommend the article. I'll link to it in the description below, as well as a couple of other articles as well, which I'll come to perhaps later. So in a nutshell, Dr. Ali, what is now, and perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, we've come some way since the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, but what now is the homosexual challenge to Muslim ethics, as you entitle your essay that you just referred to?
Yeah, well, the essay itself sought to examine certain scientific theories about the question of whether or not an individual can be born gay, because that's what the cry was at the time from the LGBTQ community, if we can call it a community, because that in itself is its own conversation by itself. Yeah. But basically, I was curious to say, well, what if someone actually can be scientifically proven to have been born gay? What particular effect would that have on Muslim morality? And how would it demand from us to make major adjustments, or would we continue on the same path and basically try work not to accommodate individuals in that particular regard? Now, I listed multiple theories that exist, that were very popular at the time, and fundamentally, what I concluded at the end of it was that although two of the theories that I showcased, one with relationship to hermaphroditism or pseudo-hermaphroditism, and the other with relationship to hormonal or androgen testosterone levels in the fetal phase of the child's development, that all the other scientific theories seem to be completely baseless. And actually, since then, in 2016, Johns Hopkins University actually released a study in a journal which was related to homosexuality, and they concluded that there is no scientific basis, right, for the claim that once some person is born gay or transgender, right, as well, right? Actually, this is, you know, and there was a big uproar in 2016 because of
clarify that. So you're saying that John Hopkins' research showed that there was no, basically, there's no biological or genetic origin or cause of this homosexuality. Is that right?
Yeah, well, basically, again, they're not saying that the science is necessarily conclusive. They're just saying based upon the current hypotheses, which have been studied and looked at very closely, that none of them hold any sway. None of them hold any, any claim of a person being born.
The idea of a gay gene, for example, this kind of media trope, is simply non-existent in terms of actual scientific research. No one's discovered in the DNA somewhere a gay gene as such.
Right, exactly. Yes, yeah, exactly. So they said that, of course, that's one of the theories, is a gay gene, one theory, course, that That some say it was is reincarnation. Some say it's because of course the hermaphrodite is a person born with both genitalia, for instance, and it may turn out that we assume that the individual belongs to the wrong sex. Another is that that brains in the when children are in their mother's womb, as they develop at a certain point, when the hormones start to be transferred to them from their mothers, right? If it's a male child, then it should have more of one particular type of hormone as opposed to another. And if it doesn't get enough of that, then the brain can turn out to be under masculinized or masculinated, and vice versa, right, with regard to female children. So, and they said that because of that, there is the there's some evidence that once they enter puberty, that individuals who have that those conditions potentially could develop attraction for the same sex, right? The Johns Hopkins study actually goes a little further and actually says that sexuality or sexual orientation, you know, those he said the term's not even scientific to begin with. Right. You know, it's that sexuality or sexual attraction, because they're, you know, multiple terms they use. They're very nebulous terms to begin with. And they say that that fundamentally it's hard to make the claim that that your sexuality is particular oriented in one particular direction, right? Yeah, throughout your life, right? Because developmental and a lot of different factors can contribute to you having, of course, more attraction to one sex than the other. You know, some but perhaps totally attracted to the to one sex, but many people have a bit more dynamism involved in their sexual attraction, right? You know, and then it depends on how we actually define those terms, right? So so it's really it's we know it's a minefield, you know, especially today, right? You know, to even have this conversation. And I'm wondering if YouTube will even censor your video, but we try our best to
I would certainly protest if they decide to censor it. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Islamically, I mean, you're the scholar and I'm not, but correct me if I'm wrong. Islamically, for example, the Sharia, the Islamic law, it seems to be concerned with behavior, actions, rather than feelings or private thoughts or even private actions in terms of when it comes to the morality of sexual behavior, I mean. And also that when it comes to the hudud punishments or punishments for actually, the main focus of the Sharia, that I understand it historically, is something called liwat. You know, that is the word, it's called liwat, which it can be translated as sodomy, which is basically the insertion of the male member into another person's backside. I don't have to put it lightly, really, because it's just that's what it is. And that seems to be the most egregious action, Sharia wise, although other forms of same sex actions are sexual activity, I should say, are also prohibited. But the catch is when there's done publicly, you know, you had like adultery or fornication, zina. So it's not really just a gay thing. This is like any action which takes place publicly, whether it be liwat or adultery or fornication, zina, whatever, is punishable. But even then, there have to be four upstanding male witnesses, usually, to the act, who then have to agree to go to court to testify that they had seen this action. And it's a very specific action they have to see without going becoming too graphic. It's not like they vaguely saw two guys doing stuff. No, they have to have witnessed actual penetration. And the same for adultery, of course, between men and women as well. The other avenue to prosecution or punishment, I should say, would be if someone voluntarily self-incriminates. So, you know, Mr. So-and-so goes to court and says on four occasions, perhaps four separate occasions, depending on the legal score, I did X, I did X, I did X, I did X. That counts as, you know, the four witnesses in one guy, and he's the guy that did it, sort of thing. But even then, you're supposed to ward off these hudud punishments, in case, you know. But that, but it's not like, you know, oh, I'm gay, therefore I must be punished, which is kind of you get the stereotype in Western understandings of Islamic law. It's very, I mean, that's a very crude summary, but is there anything that I've said that, that's completely off mark in terms of?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think I'll probably just add a couple of things. Naturally, Islam criminalizes all forms of illicit intercourse, you know, fornication, adultery, and of course, sodomy. Now, sodomy is treated unequally to the others because of the, or at least is, you know, is rationalized in such a way, or is reasoned that it has a lot to do with the fact that sodomy in particular, or this same-sex interaction, tribidism, for instance, that these commitments, that they cut off the act from the possibility of procreation, right? So adultery is seriously bad, you know, but fornication is less serious than that, but homosexual interaction or sex is considered to be worse and actually considered to be unnatural. And so for that reason, we do find punishments or crimes or punishment for these, you know, they're considered to be crimes which are punishable by Islamic law. They're sins as well, right, as we know. So not just a crime, but a sin and punishable by Islamic law. Of course, the scholars don't agree upon what the actual punishments are for sodomy, for instance. Some say that the punishment is to be flogged 100 times, and similar to a person commits fornication. Some say that the person should be stoned to death, as one would do for an adulterer. You have extreme examples or punishments such as burning people alive, which is extreme minority, you might find coming from some Shi'i circles. And then you have things like tossing someone off of a tower and then stoning them. And this is attributed to Imam Abu Hanifa, even the founder of the Hanafi school. So you do have these, you know. And so the basic concern is, as you highlighted, is public indecency, right? You know, so sexual deviance and public indecency. And for that very reason, when it talks about there being four witnesses, it doesn't say only four witnesses. It actually stipulates it be four male upright witnesses, right? And that in itself reinforces the belief and understanding that this is something that is so public that it cannot be ignored, right? And so if it's not done in such a public fashion, then the only other way that the person is incriminated is through confession, right? And we do have examples of this from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, you know, but the punishment itself was viewed by the companions clearly as a form of penance, I guess you would say. It was sort of a way to purge themselves of the sin so that they don't meet God with the sin on them, and then they'd be punished again, right? So that was, and for this very reason, we find the Prophet discouraging people from coming, one for one, confessing openly about their sin that they do secretly. And then also that he discouraged people who came admitting that they committed adultery, right? You know, but eventually those who insisted, he granted them their purification once he gleaned that there was true sincerity in those people.
Yeah, that they weren't insane or children or otherwise incapacitated or disqualified. And there are various, So, I mean, it strikes me as how extremely unlikely or virtually impossible it is for these kind of public acts of adultery or liwat, sodomy, to be proven in a court, because, you know, you have to have a number of people watching it. You know, what are they doing watching it anyway? And they have to, you know, and it has to be a very specific act. You know, why are you doing it in public anyway? I mean, you know, get a room, you know, sort of thing. But, you know, it's right. a very unlikely scenario anyway. So it's unless, of course, you're as you say, voluntarily confessing it. So
And then the other part, you're not supposed to accuse someone of doing it if you suspect that they've done it. And even if you actually witness them do it, you have to make sure that all of your witnesses, they are they're actually going to confess and admit to seeing same exact thing that you saw, right? Mm-hmm. For instance, this actually is something that happened during the reign of Umar ibn al-Khattab, where the companion Mughira ibn Shu'bah was accused of committing illicit intercourse, you know, with a woman. And Abu Bakr, who was not Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, but Abu Bakr was another companion who accepted Islam after the conquest of Mecca. And Abu Bakr, he accused Mughira of this. And he also had witnesses. So two of his witnesses admitted or also confessed, you know, that, yeah, we saw him on top of this woman and he was doing what a man would do with a woman. But his brother, Abu Bakr's brother, said, well, I saw something. I saw his backside, and I saw some movement, but I didn't really see any penetration myself. No. And because of that, Mughira wasn't punished, right?
Because three is not four. Three witnesses is not enough. You need four. Right. And then they need to go to court and actually say the right thing and not just, oh, I just saw a bit of whatever. You've got to have seen it.
So then if you can... If you can prove your case, you get punished. You get flogged 8 times, right? So
it's quite a deterrent. So the whole thing is, it seems more like a deterrence, you know, a public statement of the egregiousness of the behavior, the unacceptability of the public indecency, rather than a serious bit of legal control where people routinely get stopped and arrested and charged. So that doesn't seem to be what happens or could happen in practice at all. Right. So I mean, it is the case that, you know, places like the United States, France, Britain, Western Europe, all of Europe, Russia, you know, the Islamic law is not implemented and is not meant to be implemented. These are not Muslim societies. So the Hudud punishments are not in operation. Muslims can't take the law into their own hands, if you like, and implement Hudud. You need an Islamic society which is constituted in such a way where there is, you know, all sorts of laws in operation. And that's not the case in the West. So there's nothing to fear from anyone else, if you like, about Muslim attitudes to this, because it's not going to happen in the West. Obviously, there are countries where the Hudud punishments are, in theory or in practice, in operation, but it's certainly nowhere in the West anyway.
Right, so, yeah. I mean, this will fall under what we call the Ahkam Sultaniyah, the rules that govern the Sultan, right? In other words, the obligation to enforce them falls on the Sultan or the state, the head of state, right? That you know, and so if they're negligent, then of course they're sinful. If they, you know, and then of course, if they do enforce it, then they definitely want to make sure that they're applying it fairly, right, with everyone.
Right. So the homosexual challenge to Muslim ethics, the title of your essay, it doesn't go into a great deal of detail. It does mention that, but it's mainly concerned with the nature-nurture debate and the Catholic understanding of sexuality and natural law and so on. But how serious has been the challenge from some Muslims who advocate a revisionist view, if I can call it that, arguing the Quran doesn't actually condemn liwat, sodomy, for example. There's a particular writer, Kugel, I think his name is, who I think is an Islamic scholar. I could be wrong, but I think he might be. And he has written in a revisionist way, questioning whether or not homosexual acts in Islam are indeed haram at all. And I know there have been responses to this. So one of the best ones is by a chap called Mobeen Vade, who wrote a brilliant rebuttal of Scott Krugel's revisionism in an article called "Can Islam Accommodate Homosexual Acts?"
Right.
And I'll link to this in the description below. It's a superb piece of scholarship, and it's cited by many other scholars, like about the Islamic scholars, as a go-to text to have the issues. How much traction have these revisionist views have now, do you think? Because in the Christian community, in the Catholic Church, Anglican, Methodist, whatever, these revisionist theories are becoming increasingly popular and may even be mainstream now. But is that happened in the Muslim community?
Well, I think that I'll put it like this. I can speak about anecdotal evidence of a rejection of the of the revisionist view. Well, I mean, one, most Muslims don't even know who Scott Kugel is. Right. He's an academic. And most Muslims, you know, probably would never even know that a book trying to validate homosexuality actually exists. Yeah. However, there are, of course, more popular Muslims, right, in the West, in the political realm, who themselves have endorsed at least, endorsed, you know, an attempt to, you know, to revise this. You know, you actually can find it, people like, I'm trying to remember his name, Keith, the congressman, Keith Ellison, for instance, and back in, I think about 2001, 2002, he had a video that he posted, and he was basically calling Muslims, you know, just get over it. You know, you find people in popular, popular in social media, and some of them in the media now. You know, there was a piece that was written some years ago by Hassan Minhaj and Reza Aslan, you know, similarly coming out, yes, telling Muslims, you know, just get over it, you know. Yeah, it is what it is, and you know, you need to embrace it. You have, of course, Ilhan Omar and Nader Sarsour and Rashida Tlaib and others like that, similarities who are between people who embrace transgender people, transgenderism as something apparently valid, between embracing that and or at least just simply not being critical of it for political reasons. But the community overall, I would say, that the mosque-going community, they don't accept these ideas, that they're not in favor of teaching their children that to be gay is okay, right? And every time I've spoken publicly about this issue at Jumu'ah or something like that, that I found that, you know, the very receptive audiences, you know, to who actually they're in favor of Quranic teachings on this. Now, the idea that the Quran says nothing about sodomy is really ridiculous, you know. So and Scott Kugel, I mean, all he needed to do was, you know, just read the whole book one time, right, to know that, you know, unless he's simply just being you know, dismissive or disingenuous about what the Quran says on this issue. And it's repeated. The story of Lut or Lot is mentioned throughout the Quran multiple times, and it always mentions that this is that you prefer to approach men lustfully and you abandon women, right? And there's only one reference that I can recall that actually adds something else, you know, that you actually terrorize people on the road, that you stop people or you act as brigands or bandits on the road, right? So, so in addition to that, you know, so that's one verse, but every single verse includes mention of the issue of sodomy, you know, and this, so it utilizes euphemistic language, as the Quran utilizes, as the Arabs in general did utilize for sex. You know, there are multiple, many, many different euphemisms in the Arabic language for sex, right? And so the Quran follows that pattern as well. So it's mentioned multiple times. And so it's very clear for anyone who's objective and reasonable that the Quran condemns sodomy, that the Quran does not validate it, and that God punished the people of Sodom for this particular act, you know, that they were doing.
And of course, it's hadith as well, just to add to that, which say the same thing.
Right, exactly. Right there, and the hadith can be a bit more explicit than that. You know, that I mean, there's one hadith where there are many narrations of it, you know, but it's of questionable authenticity. Even goes as far as saying that anytime you find people doing the actions of the people of Lot, then you should kill the doer and the one who is done too, right? Mm-hmm. There's a questionable authenticity, right? You know, but as I mentioned before, there's some scholars who say this hadith is sufficient for this ruling to kill the sodomite or the individual who's actually found you know, proven to have been committed this, right? You know, that he's caught in the act, right? Or they're caught in the act. But then on the other hand, others say, well, no, the hadith is not strong enough to actually to take such a harsh measure towards these
people. It is the case that the Islamic schools, the four schools, if you like, of jurisprudence in Islam, Islamic law, there is no general agreement on the punishment for these behaviors when they are detected and punished after the caveats we mentioned, the number of witnesses and blah, blah, blah. So the Hanafi madhab, which is the most widely followed one in the world today, I believe, has no punishment, no specified punishment. So you could have a qadi, a judge, saying, you know, give a verbal rebuke to the offender, or all the way up to death, but it's not specified. So it's discretionary, it seems, for the Hanafi school. Despite the hadith you mentioned, they have a particular understanding of hadood and hadith, which we won't go into. There are other schools, which perhaps the other three, which do have a harsher normative line in terms of the punishment. But there isn't agreement, as I'm trying to say, amongst schools as to what the punishment would be anyway. And it could just be, as I say, a little, if that's the right word, as a verbal rebuke. It needn't be anything harsher than that.
Right. Yeah. There's agreement that it is a sin. There's agreement that it's punishable. Right. But there's no agreement on what the punishment should be. Right.
Yes.
So that's just the way that it is.
And so, you know, ideas of stoning and so on is you know, that's extreme end. But I'm not saying that's not there, but it is not an agreed punishment amongst all the madhabs, the Islamic.
Right. And I'll just add something like about the Hanafis that despite this, it is considered to be a very strong attribution to Imam Abu Hanifa that his opinion was that the sodomite or the individual who's guilty or found guilty of committing sodomy, that that individual should actually be taken up to a high place or a tower and tossed off, right? And then stoned thereafter, right? And it said that his analogy, he was making a similar analogy on the actual story of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. So he said, because God in the Quran, it says that he overturned the city. He turned it upside down, right? You know, and so it turned, made its bottom its top, right? And its top its bottom, and then rained down upon the city brimstone, right? So he says, okay, well, throw him off a tower, like God, you know, took the city up to the sky, according to the hadith, that the angel Gabriel carried the cities on his wings and then turned them over and then thrust them or smashed them into the ground. And then there those who were still remaining, that they were destroyed with the remaining brimstones that came from the sky. You know, but, you know, so at any rate, you know, it's as I stated, there's agreement that is sinful, there's agreement that is a crime punishable by Islamic law, but there's no agreement on what the punishment should be.
No. Now, you mentioned briefly earlier the difficulty perhaps in even getting this interview published on YouTube. is it the case, are we moving into a time in the West, not just the United States, I mean, YouTube is global, of course, although it is American, where key Islamic teachings cannot be spoken of publicly for fear of punishment, retribution, censure, job loss, fines, and so on. Are we there yet? Are we approaching that time, do you think?
Yeah, I think we're definitely approaching that time, if not already there, with regard to certain topics. Hopefully this gets a pass, right? But if it doesn't, then we'll know for certain where we've arrived, right? So, there's definitely quite a bit of censorship, and anyone who has eyes and they're working correctly can see it, right? You know, so unless you're just simply in denial, right, that there's a lot of censorship. As a matter of fact, recently YouTube decided that they're going to remove the dislike feature from videos, right, because their claims that people who are creators and they're being harassed by certain people, and they're putting the dislike button. They're putting more dislikes as opposed to likes, and they want to protect their feelings from getting hurt. You know, now some suspect that it has much more to do with the fact that the White House gets more dislikes than likes on their videos, right? And similar, right? in similar videos that are in favor of the establishment. Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have to answer this question, but as Zaytuna College, for example, are you and your colleagues able to teach the full range of Islamic subjects, ethics, morality, sexual, or do you obliged to self-censor because of Californian law or something?
No, we're not obliged to self-censor. Yeah, we teach it all, right? We teach it all.
Right, and that still continues. And you're in, the epicenter of political correctness in a way. You're in California. Yeah, right. You've exported this to the rest of the world. Well, that's not entirely fair because France had a hand in this, I think.
And
philosophers like Foucault and others. This as well. Okay, that's fine. So the homosexual change to Muslim ethics then is not really at the level of successively challenging the structure of Islamic law, because it's very clear. The hadiths are there. The Quran's there. And there's the consensus of the ulama, I take it, globally on this. Yeah. So the challenge lies elsewhere in terms of formation and discussion of these issues in a very challenging environment for all of us, but particularly for young Muslim people who are trying to find out how they should live their lives pleasingly to God, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that it's more of a sociopolitical challenge than a moral challenge, because most of the Muslims who actually support civil rights for gays and others, that they actually say that, hey, I believe that Islam does not approve of this, but we live in a secular society, therefore we have to respect people's rights to do whatever they want, right? And so in that sense, they feel, these particular people who take this perspective, they feel that they're safe by saying, okay, well, I'm not saying Islamically that it's okay, right? But I personally feel that you can't be not okay with it Islamically, but then okay with it politically either. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to go out and protest and against gays and prevent them from getting certain rights, right? Especially rights to live and to eat and things like that, right? But fundamentally, I see no distinction, right? If you're against it morally, you're against it politically, because political realm is moral realm as well. The social realm is moral as well.
You say that, Dr. Ali, but your Muslim colleagues, I'm thinking of Professor Jonathan Brown, of course, famously in the United States, is a Muslim academic. I mean, he teaches Islamic studies. He is a Muslim convert himself.
Right.
And he accepts what you say in terms of the wrongness of the actions in Sharia. But he's also advocated that Muslims in America should support the civil rights and the rights to marry, gay marriage, and so on a kind of quid pro quo basis, if I understand him right. Okay, well,
not only support,
you support our rights, because we live in a secular space and we don't agree with you, but we're going to support your right to have your thing, and therefore you can support our right to have our thing. Right. But it means that he has signed up for this agenda, this LGBTQ agenda, but for kind of pragmatic reasons, not ideological reasons. But you wouldn't agree with that, clearly.
No, I don't. And I publicly stated that I disagree with him. I privately stated to him, told him that I disagree with him about it as well. Mm-hmm. And he's taken it. He took it a step further some years ago. He had a post on European Institute's website, and there's somewhat of a debate or back and forth between him and Dr. Shadi Masri on this particular point. And he argued that Muslims should, at least my recollection is that he argued that Muslims not only should support their civil rights, but also be in alliance with them politically, because Muslims and gays are under attack from the right. Right. So the right sort of has been painted as the boogeyman for the community, and so they, Muslims who are working with the left, they see the right as an existential threat. And they'll say, okay, how can it not be when you have cases where these right wingers have actually come and killed Muslims, right? In the Masajid, for instance, in Canada, it also happened, and I think it was in Sydney, or I forget the name of the city, you know. And so we say, okay, sure, yeah, all right, those are two examples, you know, but they're anecdotal, right, in the sense that you're not talking about on a regular basis that this is something happening, right? You see, you know, so but you can understand why somebody can go that far. I think that the feeling or the assumption that there's an existential threat, right, actually is misplaced, right? It's misplaced. If anything, the existential threat, in my viewpoint, is from the left, not from the right.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't get this, Dr. Ali. I really don't get this because the right, if I can, you know, the political right, the conservative forces in the West. I mean, I think intellectually, I think of people like Professor Roger Scruton, who sadly passed away recently, had a wonderful dialogue with a colleague of yours, Zay Tuna. Mm-hmm. He was a very brilliant professor of philosophy, a professor of aesthetics at Boston, a British professor, who was conservative. But a lot of what he said is very compatible with Islam in terms of gender roles, understanding of sexuality, the purpose of sexuality, and so on. But you don't get, and he's demonized by the left, of course, but you don't get any of that on the left. The left is all about the social construction of gender and right. promoting highly unusual alternatives, shall we say. So right. It strikes me, Islamophobia apart and homophobia apart, I suppose, but Islamophobia apart, the right seems to be just as natural a place for the Republican right, even right. for Muslims to look for allies right. as the left. And of course, the left is very pro-Palestine and the right's traditionally pro-Israel in America anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit complicated, but I don't see an obvious alliance forming benefit with the left over against the right. I just don't get that.
Yeah, well, I think it's it has a lot to do with the fact that the leadership in our community, they operate, or they seem to operate, on the basis of sometimes populist sentiment and then perhaps even personal animus, which is the result of being attacked by people on the right, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you get your feelings hurt. Somebody hurts your feeling, they call your name. So now I can't work with you anymore. And this is the same problem with Black Americans overall, right? And a lot of Black people in different Western countries as well, is that we put feelings before interests, right? And if you're in a leadership position, in my position, that you can't allow the personal offense to dictate your reaction to people, right? You have to have, you know, forbearance. You have to have composure. You have to be willing to accept, you know, criticism, right? So you can say, okay, well, person, you have this criticism of me, but you're wrong for this reason, that reason. But, you know, you don't shut down and say, well, I'm not even going to have a conversation with those people because they called us terrorists one time, or they were trying to ban the Sharia, as if they actually are concerned with actually trying to implement the Sharia, right? In other words, many of the same people who are like would say that, okay, we don't like the right because when George W. Bush was in office, he had all these efforts to operate minority, about 3% minority of Republicans, according to their own research, that actually were trying to pass anti-Sharia legislation, right? And it's like, okay, well, it doesn't look to me like you actually are concerned about the Sharia, because the Sharia says that, you know, homosexual practices are haram, right? But you're actually okay with them, right? Yeah, that you're not actually trying to inform society about the potential harms of that. You're not, because when I look at the agenda, it's okay, well, you know, the agenda of Muslims is simply them parroting, right, what the left gives to them. It's not anything independent. There's no leadership being shown. It's that the Muslims are simply being shown used as proxies for the left, and that's it, right? But when we start talking about the ways that Islam is being harmed and the Muslim community is being harmed, there are many different ways, and the most egregious way has been harmed, and that's through the deterioration of faith and conviction, right? You know, that there's at this point now fear that one or two generations from now, you may not have any more Muslims, right? You see, you know, and I think that they have to take some blame for this, right? That there's a rise in atheism, a rise in people who don't want to be affiliated with religion. You know, most of those ideas are being fostered by the left, right?
Exactly. The left is traditionally atheist. It's heavily influenced by Marxism. Of course, Karl Marx, Lenin, Engels were atheists. Right. And the right, particularly in America, is quite religious. It's evangelical, right, or Catholic or conservative, which is a natural, despite issues of, you know, who is Jesus and whatever. But nevertheless, on the fundamental level of social order and morality and the Ten Commandments and so on, there's an incredible amount of overlap, right, and yet they're seen as the enemy. So the Muslims are in bed, so to speak, with the atheists, right, and have made over against the people who actually believe in God, who believe, right, in the Ten Commandments, who believe in objective morality and marriage and so on. So right, it's so ironic that these kind of weird relationships.
Yeah. And the left has always been effective at this. And this is one thing that Malcolm X had warned about. He warned about the left. And those warnings, I think, are still applicable today, right? About, like, you know, them being the most dangerous, he said the white liberal, for instance, is the most dangerous person on the planet, right?
Is that what he said?
Right, exactly. So you have to be very careful about them, you know, because he talked about the right and the left as a fox and a wolf, right? You know, that the right is like a wolf, and the lefty is like a fox. You know, so a wolf will come barking at you, and you know you're about to get hurt, right? You know, so you can actually brace for it, you know. But the fox shows you his teeth, makes you think that he's smiling at you, but he's actually preparing for a meal, right?
I like that. Malcolm X came out with some amazing stuff sometimes, didn't he?
Right, exactly.
Quite brilliant. Yeah.
Right. And he also, and then one of his other profound insights related to the media, and not that he was the only one, you know, who talked about the dangers of the media, you know, but, and if you go, you know, my Twitter page, I have his statement about the media posted there. You know,
folks, follow Dr. Abdullah Ali on Twitter. He's not a patsy of the left. You can probably guess that anyway. But it's some fascinating content. So do seek him out on Twitter. Sorry, carry on.
So again, the statement about how the media itself is the most powerful entity on the planet, right? You can make the victim look, you know, make the victim look like victimizer and vice versa, right? Right. And they control the minds of the masses. Of course, I'm misquoting it, but fundamentally, it's through, because of the fact that the media, the vast majority of the media in the West, and perhaps even in the Muslim world now, you know, it's really dominated by the left, right? The media, the academy, Hollywood, right? All those who control the imagery and the messaging are the ones who actually will determine in the minds of people who actually observe what reality is, right? You know, so our reality is mediated through these things, right? So, I mean, you can see it like come out in so many different ways. And, you know, like right now, everybody's debating about the Kyle Rittenhouse issue. And most of the people who hate Kyle Rittenhouse haven't seen the evidence. They haven't, you know, watched the testimony, you know, but they still have this negative view of him, this young man.
He didn't kill anyone. I think the people he killed were white, weren't they? I don't think he killed anyone who wasn't white. I mean, he didn't shoot.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. So there were two white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry. It's just ironic because he's seen as someone who was killing blacks or something, but he didn't actually to kill anyone or attack anyone who wasn't
white. Right, he was defending himself, right? It was a very clear case, right? And even the prosecutor and the witnesses for the prosecution, for the government witnesses are very clear that they themselves have corroborated the claim that this is self-defense, right? You know, so, but again, people continue to run with what they think they know, right? See, so there's a lot of brainwashing that's happening. And so most of the time when I'm posting about things, I'm constantly trying to raise awareness about how the establishment is manipulating us and dividing us, right? You know, so that's why I focus so much on the media, right? And people have to understand that there are relationships, you know, it's not just the media, it's also Hollywood, it's also the academy, it's also the federal law enforcement, even sometimes, you know, the government itself, the military, right? Yeah, because the military has contracts with, you know, major, you know, Twitter, YouTube, a lot of these major big tech corporations as well, right? So at any rate, you know, I don't want to go too far off the topic, but I do think it's related. It's related to what we're talking about. And I do think that what needs to be understood, in particular, when I speak about these issues about homosexuality and others, is that I'm not speaking from the standpoint of the person who hates, like, people who are gay or transgender and things like that. I'm concerned about it because I do believe that it is the probably the most important area of concern today, in that all ethical systems are built upon a particular theory about the human being, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And so fundamentally what's happening today is that our definition of the human being is being changed. That there's an attempt to rewire our brains to think a certain way, right? And I have family members who are gay. I grew up with gay family members. I mean, my mother's sister, she's been a lesbian for decades. Her son is bisexual. I had a gay cousin who died about 7-8 years ago, right? So I grew up around this, you know. So it's not as if, and when I see them, I hug them, you know, kids. I mean, we're family, right? You know, so it's not as if, like, I'm not familiar with people who struggle with these problems. And I do think that there are some people who realize that about me. And this is why in the past I've had people write me in private. You know, I remember there was a Muslim guy who wrote me and told me that, you know, I read your article and it really touched me. You know, I just want to let you know I never confessed this to you, because he had been in contact with me for a number of years. And so he said, I used to be gay. I used to be in a relationship with men. And after I became Muslim, I continued to do these things, you know, but then I decided I'm going to try to now seek a relationship with a woman, right? However, certain members of the mosque are aware of my past. So every time I get close to actually starting a relationship with a woman, people will let her know, okay, about my past, and then it gets broken off. There was another guy, I remember he contacted me, his mother was a lesbian. And so he says that I really struggled with this for a lot of years. And once I read your article, it made me understand my mother better. Right. Mm. So there, you know, it's out of compassion. It's out of, and also out of concern that we lose our understanding of the human being, right? Because, you know, listen, a man who thinks he's a woman is now a woman, right? And vice versa. It's like, well, no, or the pronouns he, she, and all these things don't mean anything anymore. At least they're attempting to try to make these things not have any meaning anymore.
Entirely optional.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, or just make them entirely optional. You know, I just, right. I decide if I'm he, she, or, you know, by an act of will, but it could be no recognition to science or the biology, right, or the chromosomes or the physiology, right, of the person concerned, which seemed, right, sort of a kind of very Gnostic kind of understanding of human nature, which is very different from the Islamic Jewish Christian one anyway.
Right. Yeah. And this was interesting too, coming back to the John Hopkins study. You know, this is one of the things that they stated in there at the very beginning. They said that this distinction between sex and gender, there's no scientific basis for it. They actually say that literally, like that you know, that there's no scientific basis for distinguishing between sex and gender, or that gender is something unconnected to a biological sex.
Right? Yeah.
So, and actually, there was a big outcry about this study, and they were trying to get it retracted, right? Wow. But they weren't successful, you know, because they're still selling it. You can still go buy it from the John Hopkins website. You can buy the actual journal. Entry of that particular edition of the journal called the New Atlantis.
But I wonder if such research could even be undertaken today, let alone publish in today's climate. In 2020.
Right, yeah, probably not, you know, because that was 2016, now 2021, about to go into 2022. And it seems that all of the main sources of reality, of mediated reality, have all colluded and concluded that this is what people need to conform to. And I see it. My daughter, she's in high school. She has friends who actually have bought into these ideas. I would say that what is good, that there are many of the students who haven't, right, who still resist it, even here in California, right? There's some
even in California. But that strikes me that a lot of people out there, even in California then, who are silently dissenting from this, having to bite their tongues because they're not able to speak because of the sanctions against free speech on these issues. So it's not like silence may not mean that everyone agrees. It's just not everyone can speak out anymore. And it's a that's not a healthy thing for society being where traditional views are suppressed. That's not healthy at all. Can't be.
Right, right. Yeah. So so when you're muddling with language, you're muddling with the assumptions about human nature. Mm-hmm. You are trying to redefine the human being. And then add on top of that, the particular, I guess you'd say the particular assumptions are connected with other assumptions, which make it easy for many people to assume that there is a larger plan to promote anything that is in favor of population reduction. Right. So conspiracy theorists or conspiracy factors, however you like to express it, you know, but there's good reason to feel that way, right? You know, that because the question is, why promote something that such an extreme minority of people actually are, you know, struggling with, right? Why should try to normalize that?
The tail wagging the dog, because you're right, the actual numbers of people affected directly by these issues, whether it be homosexual oriented people or transgender, are very tiny number of people, and yet that has become politicized and is opposed on the overwhelming majority of the population, which strikes me as an extraordinary thing to have achieved, a tail wagging the dog, you know, remarkable achievement. I wouldn't have thought it was possible, but it's happened, obviously.
Yeah, right, right. And then we could even question the claim that LGBTQ represents a community, right? When we actually know that there's a lot of diversity among those people. Mm-hmm. There are people who are gay, bisexual, lesbian, who actually identify with the right. They identify with the right. There are those who don't like to be placed under the category of queer. They're gay and lesbian people who don't like that. So, no, I'm not queer, I'm gay or I'm lesbian. And then you have the clash between gays, lesbian, bisexuals, and transgenders, you know, where it's just like, well, no, transgender, you don't belong here, right? Because our identities or our orientations are built upon the sexual binary, right? You know, how can I be gay if, you understand, if the binary it has no meaning, right?
It's too messed up to even begin to think about it. It's just I just wanted to recommend a couple of books that I've got. This one, Sex Matters, Love, Marriage, and the Sunnah, a publication of MuslimMatters.org. And there is a chapter in it which I quite like, by a guy called Brother Yusuf, entitled From a Same-Sex Attracted Muslim, that's himself, Between Denial of Reality and Distortion of Religion. So he accepts Islamic teaching, of course, but he explores what that means for him subjectively, personally, as a person who wrestles with these issues. But this book also uncovers heterosexual marriage and masturbation and secret marriages and all sorts of things. Actually, really quite a good little book. From the Christian side, this little booklet really is called Same-Sex Unions, the Key Biblical Texts. Now, this is a British publication. The author's Ian Paul, the British minister, Church of England, although he is actually a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in California, actually, as well. But he's a conservative Christian, a biblical scholar, and he looks at the Old Testament texts and the New Testament texts about homosexuality, Paul, and so on, in the light of biblical scholarship. And he comes to the conclusion that the traditional understanding of these texts certainly holds up, despite the revisionist attempts to pretend they don't say what people might not want them to say. And lastly, this is a bit more hard line, this book, but I still would recommend it, Why Homosexuality is Prohibited in Islam. And the author is Abu Zainab Abd al-Rahman al-Kawim. Now, this book, you can download it or PDF. I did it earlier on online. online, so you don't have to buy it. And this is certainly a very traditional understanding, but it's informed by the science and the scholarship and the academic issues. So that's quite an erudite text as well. Is there anything that you recommend for people to pursue these subjects further, apart from your Twitter, I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, this is, recently I haven't been posting much about this particular topic, you know, but as I stated before, that when I had written my original article, that I don't recall any other articles being available, you know. So in that sense, it was somewhat of a pioneering piece. But I do want to just make one point about that essay that I'd written, is that there's a mistake in it that I still haven't updated, you know, and this relates to the story of the man who used to be in the presence of the Prophet Muhammad. Wives, right? You know, and I mentioned in the actual essay that he was a pseudo hermaphrodite. Actually, that's an error. He was just simply an effeminate man, right? You know, even though later in the article, I do talk about him being effeminate, right? You know, so it's somewhat of a contradiction in the actual essay, but that's something I haven't updated. You know, I've been meaning to do so, but just haven't done it. You know, it's just remains there, you know, so I want to be clear. But anyway, when it comes in terms of books, the Johns Hopkins study, like for instance, you have this it's the special report on sexuality and gender from 2016. That's probably one probably a good book. They have a book here by Mark Yarhouse. This is Homosexuality, the Use of Scientific Research in the Church's Moral Debate. Right, that's an important book, I think, for anyone. Another one is Conundrum, The Evolution of Homosexuality by N.J. Peters, which I believe actually is a feminist, as she's a woman writing. And so she talks about the issue of sociobiology and how homosexuality to evolutionary biologists have been much of a puzzle, a conundrum. Yeah. Right? So yeah. They feel that, okay, well, why has it continued to exist? Why does it continue to reemerge? You know, because if you believe in, you know, evolutionary biology, then it's the gene, if there's a gene, then it should have sort of ruled itself away, right? Yeah.
It's not exactly helping the evolutionary process, is it? Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's another one too called The Puzzle. Exploring the evolutionary puzzle of male homosexuality by Lewis Berman. It's a pretty thick book, you know. But
is that a new book? Is that a new book or?
No. This is not new. I can't remember exactly, but let me see.
I'm not familiar with that. Yeah. That's very helpful.
Yeah, I think it was written a long time ago, early 20th century, actually. 1935 looks like it. 1935 actually written. The puzzle. And then one last one. This one is called Understanding Gender Dysphoria. This one is by Mark Yarhouse once again. There are many books you can look at to get a deeper understanding of this issue if you have an interest. Right? But those are the books that I rely on, like right now. And when I wrote my article, I utilized a lot of studies, online studies from journals to build my argument there. And so fundamentally, I started and I talked about how the Catholic Catechism, it states that the psychological etiology of homosexuality is undetermined. Yeah. And I say it in the same way, the biological and physiological and similar bases is also undetermined. And that's really what I attempted to prove there. So that really in the moral realm, there's not any reason for Muslims to say that people are born gay or that a transgender person is who they believe they are. And so there's no reason to sort of make any adjustments, right? At least morally, right? Now, in pragmatic terms, that's a different question altogether, right? So how do you navigate it? How you navigate this issue politically and socially? And I generally would tell people, in particular, we start talking about the matter of the pronouns, Like I tell my kids, well, my son's still not completely aware of these things. He's still 9 years old, but my daughter, who's 17, I've always told her that when people come to you and start to say to you that you must utilize a particular pronoun to refer to them when they're not around or when you're talking about them, I suggest that you tell them, no, that you're not going to use a particular pronoun, but you just simply refer to them by their name. Right. So when you're talking about them, I'll just call you by your name. What's your name? What name do you prefer?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's as far as the compromise we can make there. Right. Because anything else is capitulation. Yeah. It's corruption of language. It's corruption of community as well, because community is based upon having common nouns and common understandings and common words. Right. You know, so we become like the Tower of Babel. Right. When we just, words only mean something to the speaker, right? And every time we speak to them, we can only understand what they mean once the speaker defines them to us, right? And tells us, this is what I mean by this word. And so, and you have to use it in the way that I use it. I say, well, no, I don't have to, right? And and if you have a name, I refer to you by your name. You know, and so that's as far as we can go. So that's the way that I generally deal with that one issue.
Yeah, it's very thorny. Is there anything in conclusion? We've been talking for just over an hour now. Anything you'd like to, in conclusion, share with us about this complex and vexed subject?
Islam is opposed to any illicit intercourse, right? And it doesn't mean that all types of illicit intercourse are the same, as stated before. Fornication is wrong. Adultery is wrong. But also sodomy and tribadism are wrong as well. What creates a major challenge, you know, and perhaps even leads to a lot of animus towards religious people, not just Muslims, but religious people in general, I think, is that we live in a highly promiscuous, or we live in highly promiscuous societies, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and even religious people are very promiscuous, right? Well, people associated with religious groups are very promiscuous. So for a person who happens to be gay or otherwise, may have very strong reason to feel, right, that you're being very hypocritical when you single them out and say, well, you're actually committing sin too.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Why are you focused only on me? Right.
Yeah.
You know,
because the cohabitation between a man and woman is perfectly accepted now. And yet that is a sin, both in Catholicism and in Islam.
It's right. Right. Exactly. So, and again, that's not to belittle the severity of homosexual sex. Right. But it's simply just to make a point that, you know, that, that everyone has, everyone's redeemable. Everyone's redeemable. So unless a Muslim in particular is trying to justify homosexual acts, then we should try our best to be patient with those individuals who come our way, because often people are coming for help. They're looking for help. And if you're one who can help that person, then sure, go right ahead and try to direct them in the right direction. You know? So like this brother Yusuf, for instance, in the from the article that you were highlighting from the book, Sex Matters, you know, individual among others who actually struggle with same-sex attraction, but is not trying to validate or justify his attraction. Right? You see, basically saying, okay, this is an issue. This is a fitna for me. This is a test that I have. Right. And I choose not to act on my urges. Right. So this is the other thing, too, is that because we live in such promiscuous societies, what has been suggested is that, well, other people are allowed to act on their urges. So why can't I act on my urge?
Yeah.
Right. So they're committing sin. And even if you consider your sin to be my sin to be worse than yours, you know, we're equal in that we're both committing sin. Right. But Islam says, well, no. You're supposed to be a master of yourself, right? You're not supposed to allow your urges, your appetites to rule you, to have mastery over you. You're supposed to have mastery over your urges. And this is why when the prophet talked about young people getting married, you know, young men, you know, ya ma'ashar shabab, you know, that old young men, you know, if you have the capacity, then marry. But if you're not able to marry, then fast, because fast acts as castration. In other words, a limited form of consecrated celibacy or monasticism, I guess you would say, right? You know, so you can, yes, you can restrain yourself, you can abstain, right? And it's not much different from an individual, a man, he may be married and maybe he's contemplating adultery, right? You know, so should he act on his urge? No, he should restrain himself. You see, and remind himself, I have this at home already, right? You see, you know, that you all of us struggle with things, you know, with our tongues, with our eyes, different parts of our bodies that we struggle with our urges, you know. So fasting teaches us that you can give up the things that you don't need, right? Because the fasting requires of you to give up the things that you need, right? Your food, drink, sexual gratification, right? And so you successfully complete that every single year, 29 or 30 days every single year. And one of the lessons that I learned, particularly from fasting, is that if you can give up the things that your body needs, then you can give up the things that your body doesn't need, right? Mm-hmm. So fasting itself is a way towards controlling our urges, you know? So you can't be a pious person if you don't have good control of your urges, right? Is that piety has always, or appetites, emotions have always, and the control of those things have always had an integral place or role in determining whether or not a person is pious, right? The prophet said, if you control what is between your two jaws, between your two thighs, I will safeguard for you paradise. Right. So you have to have control over yourself. The Quran in Surah An-Nazi'at, أَمَّا مَنْ خَافَ مَقَامَ رَبِّهِ وَنَهَى النَّفْسَ عَنِ الْهَوَى فَإِنَّ جَنَّتَهَا الْمَأْوَى, that whoever fears standing before his Lord and restrains or prevents his nafs, himself, from his lust, then paradise is his refuge. Paradise is his refuge, you know. So the Quran is constantly calling us to this, you know. So mind over matter. Mind over matter, you know, that we don't allow the lower desires to rule us, that we utilize the higher appetite, the will, should have mastery over the carnal appetites, right? So any person who's struggling with any type of thing, be it, again, drugs, be it porn addiction, be it, you know, again, homosexual urges, right? That we have the power, we have the strength to overcome that. And I would just, again, coming back to the John Hopkins study, making the point about how our sexuality is not as static. Sexual attraction is not as static for most people, right, as we generally think it is, right? So even to classify yourself as heterosexual, homosexual, right, that those particular classifications can be somewhat problematic because they're not scientific terms in that you may, again, depending on the person, right, you know, you might find certain men attractive. That doesn't necessarily mean that you want to sleep with them, but you might find them attractive, or a woman may find a woman attractive. Doesn't necessarily mean that they want to sleep with them either. Yeah, but understand that these terms are not scientific. Sexual attraction, homosexuality, heterosexuality are not really stable scientific terms that scientists themselves, the scientific community, actually rely heavily upon, right? You know, and so in other words, what that means is that simply, even if a person, they're actually suggesting that even if a person had a homosexual relationship in the past, that doesn't necessarily make you a homosexual now, right? Yeah, even if you still have those urges, right? You just say, okay, well, you had a homosexual experience, right? Right? And vice versa, right? It can be the same, you know. So of course, heterosexuality has an advantage over homosexuality in that, from a naturalistic standpoint, you can, and biological standpoint, physiological standpoint, that you can argue that this itself, you know, God created the female body to complement the male body and vice versa, right? And that's why there is, you know, of course, lubrication and all these other things that go, you know, and then also the access or creating a path towards procreation and prolonging the human species is there, right? So, so there's just quite a bit here. And I do think that these are important points for people to reflect upon. It's, I feel like I'm forgetting one thing here, but we can perhaps leave it there. And we hope that this video is beneficial, and I hope that people, that it doesn't get censored as well, you know, because it's an important topic. It's a very sensitive issue that many people actually are struggling. They want to do better. And I do think that Muslims have to be a bit more mature on this particular point. And that doesn't mean that we need to take a public pastoral position. And what I mean by that is that it seems that the official position to take is one that favors psychology or psychological treatment of the individuals who struggle with these type of issues, with transgenderism or same-sex attraction, gender confusion, you know, and such, that we have to reinforce and affirm those people. I don't think that that's the right way to go, right? You know, in the public sphere, right? Because most people are just not there. I don't think they're ever going to be there. Most people are ever really going to be there. You know, they might silence themselves, right? You know, but they're never really going to be there. Whereas, this is actually reality, right? This is science, right? Right. Rather, I think that we maintain the Islamic teachings publicly, you know. However, right, when we have people who approach us and they're having these struggles, then we try to be a bit more compassionate and understand that all of us could be addicted or struggle with our urges from time to time. And we might need that extra push, that extra help, so that we can actually gain mastery over ourselves. Mm.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thank you very much, Professor Abdullah Ali. And I too obviously hope that this time together can be uploaded onto YouTube without censorship. It's horrible to even have to ask that question. Actually, I think it's appalling, but it's the reality of the world we live in at the moment. So thank you so much. And I'm sure people will find what you said to be a great benefit. And the very fact that we can even talk about it, assuming we can actually get this up, is a breakthrough, and will give people space to think outside of the prescribed boxes that we're told to think about these issues, and to think perhaps more in terms of what God may want of us rather than what the media may want of us, because there is a difference. Thank you very much, and I'll leave it there. So until next time.
Thank you, Paul.